Last time talked about epimorphisms, monomorphisms, and what it means for every morphism to be factored essentially uniquely into a epi followed by a mono, so the usual factorization over the image. And I just want to make a remark, could have made last week already, is remember, if you have a morphism F from X to Y in some category C, then to say that F is a mono was equivalent of one way of defining it is to say that the induced map of sets is injective, and similarly, to say it's an epimorphism, one has it, so it's injective for all, for each Z and C, and similarly, an epimorphism was the dual version, is again injective. So one can ask, well, what happens if one tries to sort of do the crossover here? In other words, why wouldn't we say, for example, so what about saying that HOM C from Z X to HOM C Z Y is surjective. Or, instead of, to use this to define an epimorphism. Well, let's see what that means. See what is this map here? Well, this map here is just post-composition with F, right? So you take any morphism X, to Z, and then, from Z to X, which is G, and then you compose it with F to get FG. So what would it mean to say that this one is surjective? Well, this would mean that given any morphism H from Z to Y, we are given F, can we fill in here to make this diagram commutative? In other words, this question here is whether any morphism from Z to Y can be lifted through F. And that is precisely the starting point of cohomology theory. Because what cohomology theory is intended to do is to set up a framework where we can decide what it means or under which circumstances we have a positive answer. In other words, what kind of morphisms F have the property that you can lift. So that's something completely different from these two basic notions of a monomorphism or an epimorphism. And similarly, if we look at sort of the other variant, so what were to say, so what about the missing one? So what about C, Y, Z to HOM C, X, Z surjective. Well, again, let's look what it means. So we'll start with a morphism from Y to Z. We have given the morphism from X to Y, and the image of under G of G under this map here is simply the composition GF. So what would it mean for this to be surjective? Well, it would mean to say, given any morphism X to Z, we can find a morphism here to fill in the diagram. So in other words, we would have given a morphism, we were given a morphism from X to Z, can we extend it to Y? Or again, can we factor it through F? So can we factor H through F? And so if you think of F, for example, as an inclusion of some kind, subgroup into a group, a topological space into a topological space, then this becomes an extension property. Which morphisms F have the property that you can extend? Now, this is a very vague question, and in this vagueness there's no good answer. You will have to put extra conditions. For example, might only be possible for certain morphisms, and it might only be possible for certain targets that you can actually do that. But these two questions, this one and this one, which are dual to each other, they are really at the origin of cohomology theory. Because what cohomology theory tries to do is to give effective criteria that allow you to decide what happens. So I just thought I would make this as a remark, so in case you wonder what happens to the other two properties one could impose on these induced maps on sets. So, last time we saw the definition of functors and morphisms between them, also known as natural transformations. And set theory notwithstanding, so first of all, if we have functors, so we have two functors such a way between three categories, then that follows immediately from the definition, then GF, just simply composing the two functors, gives a functor from C to E. And of course, what does it do? Well, we have to assign something to every object. If you have an object X and C, then F of X is an object in D by definition, that F is a functor. And then to this object, we can assign the object G of F of X in E. And similarly, if we have a morphism from X to Y, then we have, first of all, the morphism F of F between F of X and F of Y because F is a functor, and then we can apply G to the whole situation to find a morphism between the desired objects and the required commutativity. So if you have a composition of two morphisms here, follows from the fact that it holds for F and G separately. So that's the composition of functors, which is a pretty simple and basic concept, not much to it. However, morphisms between functors are sort of, at least initially, often a source of for confusion, and the reason for it is, well, I will explain in a second, but so the first statement, I don't even want to call it a lemma because it's really a very simple thing, is that given categories C and D, then from C to D is, so that should be the category of all functors with morphisms of functors as morphisms, of course. So I should say it was natural transformations as morphisms, but because they are the morphisms for this category, that's why I usually don't use the word natural transformation. So that's a pretty straightforward verification just from the definitions. However, note that the size of this category is somewhat dubious. So if C is small, everything is fine, because then remember, how do you define a functor? A functor assigns to each object something else. Now, if the objects do not form a set, so then this kind of assignments do not form a set. So one has to be careful that as soon as you take morphisms between categories, you are blowing up potentially the size. Now, if you only do it once, you can still keep it under control, but if you sort of keep on doing it, then make sure you understand that you don't run afoul of logic. So, where does the slight confusion come from with morphisms or functors? And that is because we have two kinds of composition. So, first of all, let's look at the following situation. So, let's see, we have F and G, and then the second pair of functors between the same, involving the same categories, and then we might have a morphism of functors from F to F prime, and we might have a morphism of functors from G to G prime. So let me first say, well, let me first stick to this. So just the fact that the morphisms between a fixed pair of categories qualify as morphisms of a category themselves, well, that's just saying that this composition here. So remember, how is such a morphism given? So that alpha is given by assigning to each x in C, you have to assign a morphism alpha x from f of x to g of x. Sorry, f prime. And, of course, you have to have the naturality condition. If you have any morphism from X to Y and C, then this diagram has to commute, where here you have alpha X and here you have alpha Y. Now, clearly, if you have two such things, well, that just means you continue your drawing here. And then you see if the first diagram commutes and the second diagram commutes, then of course the outer diagram commutes as well. So that's why the composition of two morphisms of functors is again a morphism of functors. However, if you start to mix things up, well, then we can do various things. So for example, we know, let's say, that alpha is basically given by a family of morphisms from one for each object in C. Now, we can apply G to this whole situation. And then we have a morphism of functors here, so we can apply beta on the object f prime of x to get us to g prime f prime of x. So, and this is sometimes called, there's no standard notation. I'll just note it by an asterisk for the moment. So you see, we have sort of normal vertical composition of morphisms of functors in this diagram, in this picture, but we also have a composition of a morphism from F to F prime and a morphism from G to G prime. And now the question becomes, what are the various laws that hold in this kind of situation? So when first of all, one writes this shorter, so that, well, I should put an X here. So beta star alpha is a morphism of functors from GF to G prime F prime. So morphism. Now, when things really... No. What do you mean? Just tell me. Yes, that's right.
And then to G prime of the prime X, we are alpha, G prime composed with alpha.
Yes, and so we can insert the whole thing into a diagram like this. Yes, and so the claim is this diagram commutes. And that is somewhat confusing because you see in this, if you read it this way around, then it is saying that you really do compose alpha with beta. Whereas if you do it this way around, you compose beta with alpha. So why does this diagram commute? No, thank you. So why is this diagram commutative? And if you have never really worked with this kind of stuff, then this is certainly very confusing. So give me one reason or two why this diagram commutes.
This is
So why does it commute? I mean, after all, I make a claim, so there must be a proof, right? What's a proof? Well, look at these two things. Alpha X is a morphism from F of X to F prime of X. And beta is a morphism of functors from G to G prime. So, if you apply that beta is a morphism from G to G prime, and alpha X is a morphism from F of X to F prime of X, well, then it says that makes the diagram commutative. So here you look at alpha X as the given morphism, and you use that beta is a morphism of functors. And so by naturality of beta means that this diagram commutes. So naturality of beta, and I'll say over alpha, diagram commutes. So what happens if you use that alpha is a natural transformation of functors? We do that as well. Okay. So the diagonal in this diagram, so that's what I call beta star alpha of x. So now what happens, and that's where the real confusion comes up, if we have this kind of thing. So by the way, first of all, I should say how one abbreviates this. So you see, this x is just a token placeholder. It does not really intervene. It means it is, has to be, this is true for any object x in the source category. So one can write this simply as saying that g prime alpha composed with beta f equals beta f prime composed with g alpha. And this whole thing is called beta star alpha. So we have some kind of commutativity here, but not quite, right? There is no... So what happens if we have this kind of situation? So now we can do lots of things, right? We can do the sort of the vertical composition, alpha prime with alpha, beta prime with beta. So we could do, for example, we could do alpha prime alpha, which is a morphism from F to F double prime, and then we could use beta prime beta because that's a morphism from G to G double prime. And so, question is, can we could of course do beta alpha star. I'm going to get this right. And we could as well do beta prime star alpha prime. So beta alpha would get us a morphism from here to here. Well, let me not write it this way. So beta star alpha gives us a morphism from GF to G prime F prime, and beta prime star alpha prime gives us a morphism here. And so we simply can take the vertical, the composition here. Right, so these are just natural morphisms of functors from C to E. And so the claim is, and this is sometimes called the Hilton-Ekman relation . So you have some kind of distributivity where it doesn't matter which of the two operations you put inside and which one you put outside. Also, both operations, dot and star, have the same identities. So what's the identity, for example, for the vertical composition? Well, clearly, if we have a functor f from C to D, then, again, we get for free a morphism of functors, which is just the identity everywhere. Right? So this would be the identity on f. It is just a morphism. Remember what it means to give a morphism of functors? We need to give a map from a morphism from f of x to f prime of x, which happens to be f of x, and of course a morphism is simply the identity. Now clearly we have, so if I stay my picture there, we have that alpha composed with the identity on f equals the identity on f prime composed with alpha. Yeah. Nothing mysterious there, and that's of course built into the statement over there that the morphisms of functors are the morphisms of a category, and that these are clearly the identity maps. Now what happens if we take a beta star the identity on f? So if alpha here were the identity, well clearly nothing happens. Just look at the diagram there. So this is just going to be beta. And similarly, if we take the identity on G prime and we compose it, sorry, with alpha, no, this is what I want. No, the identity beta. No. Of course, if I take beta and the identity on F, I get beta applied on F, right? It has to be a morphism from functors from C to E to C to E. And similarly, if we take the identity, say, on G star alpha, we simply get G alpha. Now, let's assume, and so this is the point I want to make, so this is an aside, a very crucial one, and we'll come back later. Assume you have two operations, star and dot, satisfying one, the Ekman-Hilton, the Hilton-Ekman and secondly, has the same, or have the same two-sided identities. So think of it in terms of algebra. You have plus and times, you have this kind of distributivity law, and you have also that the unit element for both operations is the same. What can you conclude? And so just to make it more precise here, let's say on a set S. So just think of it as a set with two binary operations satisfying this relation up there, this distributivity law, and having the same two-sided identity. Identity. What can you conclude? And that's the famous theorem by Hilton and Ekman. It follows that both operations have to be commutative. And where do you use this? Respectively, all the higher homotopy groups are abelian. So, then... Yeah. Then... star and dot are commutative. And application, pi I x, I greater or equal to 2 is abelian. And that's why it's called the Ekman-Hilton or Hilton-Ekman argument. By the way, I was told that the Russian school, they knew also the higher fundamental groups of abelian, and that's why they were discarded as not interesting. Of the H space, that's what you need here, right? Yes, because you just think of this as pi 1 of whatever, omega, I suspect. So, but let's give a proof of this. I'm not, don't want to give you this one here, but just give a proof to see how this works. So let's say E, so if E is the identity, then what can we say? Well, for example, we can take let's see, where do we want to put it? So we want we'll take beta prime equal to E equal to alpha. So what do we get? Then the first line reads beta prime beta star alpha prime alpha is simply E beta star alpha prime E. And because E is an identity element, this is the same as beta star alpha prime. If you look at the other one, then we get beta prime star alpha prime dot beta star alpha, which by our assumption translates into E star alpha prime dot beta star E. And of course, because E is also the identity with respect to star, this is alpha prime dot beta. So it's just a slight problem that I have the different. So we know that these two are the same. And, of course, I want it to be really commutative, so how do I do this? So I guess I need some help from the audience here because I didn't sufficiently prepare. So you've seen it once, you'll never forget it. So, but apparently it's possible. So how do we extricate ourselves from here? Say this again? Okay, slowly. A? Yes. Yes, okay. That's, of course, the same thing as we had before. To this one. Ah, okay. So then we get, yes, so we get E dot B is beta star. No, then we get just back this one, right? Alpha star. We'll just get back this.
Another idea. delta sine alpha prime e, you can replace the order of d delta n. So the middle thing in the first equality
here,
d delta sine star alpha prime e.
Yes.
Replace it by beta e star.
Okay, yeah, here we go. Yeah, so this, because E is a two-sided identity, which we haven't really used that, but we can write this, yes, thank you very much. We can rewrite this, so E is a two-sided identity. Right. And so now we'll just use the distributivity law and write this as beta star E dot alpha prime star E. And then again, this becomes beta times alpha prime. Yeah, okay, fine, great. And this shows commutativity of this one. Okay, let's see. Let's see here. The D stays at the end. Yes, so it's E star alpha prime. Yes. The first and the last term don't move, and the ones in the middle. Yeah. Yeah. Wow. But it's better to get it done properly, yes. So we get, and then by what we already had before, so we can rewrite this as alpha prime star beta, and so we get both of them are commutative and coincide. So they are commutative and coincide. So pretty crazy thing, right? It does not need any, I mean, this, if you wouldn't tell the kids the distributivity laws for plus and times, it would start with this. Well, you would spoil a whole generation, but other than that, they would probably be able to understand the formal argument, if they understand formal argument. So, I mention this here in some detail because it is also, as turns out, and that took a long, long time, to realize this is precisely the argument that underlies the commutativity of Hochschild cohomology. One of the most puzzling statements was a theorem by Gerstenhaber from 1963, where he said no matter what algebra you have, the Hochschild cohomology that carries the natural product is always graded commutative. And he gave a very elaborate proof, Annals of Mathematics, some 60 to 80 pages. Now, it was realized later that you could considerably shorten the proof, and there's a very basic one, but still you have to work to get it. And it's not quite clear if you use this kind of standard techniques, what is the utmost generality in which this theorem holds. But it was realized just a few years ago, as I think 2002, that you can reduce it very simply to the Ekman-Hilton argument. So this is a trick or an insight which perhaps is useful in other situations as well. So perhaps worthwhile remembering. That's right. So the difference, and that's why I called it an aside, because it doesn't have an immediate application here, is that the identities are not the same throughout. Right? There are different identity functors that serve as left and right identities. Yes? For the two operations. So that's Well, in a sense, you could argue that this diagram here is displays a kind of commutativity, right? It says alpha beta is the same as beta alpha, properly understood.
But still, you have a category theory remnant, which is this natural transformation from a functor to itself is an abelian group.
Yes, that's true. Yes, an abelian monoid. Yes, that's true. And that's a good point. Okay, thank you very much. Definition. If C is any category, then you can define its center. And that will look very strange, but I'll just do it here because of the discussion we just had. Then the center of C is Z of C is all the endomorphisms of the identity functor of C. So just look at all endomorphisms of the identity functor. Why would you call this the center? Well, let's assume we have such a thing. Well, that means that for each object, you have given an endomorphism of that object. Because what does it mean to be a morphism from the identity to the identity? It just means whenever you evaluate an object, you get an honest morphism. So evaluate on an object X, you get an honest morphism. If you take any other morphism from X to Y, to say that's a natural transformation of functors means that this diagram commutes for all F. So, reading it backwards, if you happen to have a family of endomorphisms on your gadgets, on your objects, such that all such diagrams commute, well, then these families of morphisms put together form an endomorphism of the identity functor. So that's, when you think of them, so Z, forgetting about the indices, commutes with all morphisms. So the result then is, if the center of C is a set, which is not by all means given, depends on the size of your category, then the center of C, together with composition of morphisms of functors, is an abelian monoid, as Drawer already pointed out. So that's sort of one application one gets from here. Now, perhaps it's worthwhile, even though I'm jumping a little bit here, to see that in at least in some case, you get back what you are asking for. And I'm jumping ahead, and I will point out at each step what I mean by this. And so this is a lemma by Gabriel. Let's not go there for the moment. Namely, if C is, say, the category mod R, where R is any ring, and remember, this is the category of right R modules, then the center of C is naturally isomorphic to the center of R. And what's this isomorphism? Well, you have an morphism of the identity functor, and you simply evaluate it on R itself. This is a map from R to R, and thus, if you evaluate it on 1, then you get, so you can identify this or whatever you like to call it. So So then ZR applied to 1 is an element in the center of 1. Now here's a proof. And I like this proof because it sort of gives, it's very simple, but it uses these ideas up there. So the first thing is that this map is surjective. In other words, whatever I have in the center of a ring, I can sort of blow it up and make it into a natural transformation of the identity. So if R is an element in the center of the ring, then define, well, maybe I call it R underlined of the module M simply to be right multiplication with R on the R module M. Remember, M is a right R module, so I can multiply from the right, and in particular, I can multiply with an element from the center from the right. But then, because it's in the center, you look at to say what it means that this is a transformation of the identity. Well, what do we have to show? We have to show if we have two modules, R modules, and we have an R linear map, that the multiplication with R is compatible, that this diagram commutes. Well, that's just linearity. So let's see, okay, let's see some skeptic faces. So let's trace it element by element. What does it mean? Well, if we start with an element M here, we multiply by R from the right to get M times R, and then we apply phi to it. If we go the other way around, then we first apply phi and then multiply by R. And clearly, these two things are the same as phi is R linear. So, but where does the centrality of R come in? Well, the centrality comes in to say that R is R linear. Multiplication by R is R linear. That it is indeed something defined in this category. Right? Because that means that you have to have that M, let's say R prime times R, has to be equal to M times R, R prime. In other words, that you can move the R prime out. After all, it should be an R linear map. And so that's where, because you have to have it for all modules, in particular, you have to have it on the ring R itself, in particular for little m equal to 1. So that means that R has to be in the center if it is supposed to define such a map. So that gives surjectivity. So thus, this map Z maps to ZR of 1 is surjective. Now, the nice thing is to prove its injectivity, which really shows how to work with this kind of stuff. Now, so, injectivity. Well, the first thing, so you start with an element in the center. So the first thing to prove is that ZR of 1 is in the center of R. Probably should have done the very beginning to show that this map is actually well defined. But that's just the same, the thing which we said there. So the second thing is that, and that's where I'm jumping ahead, it follows that Z on any free module is equal to right multiplication with this element, little r. So in other words, so this here, so this is just the free module, free R module on a basis indexed by I. Now why is that? Because, you see, if we want to understand what this map does to an element in this free module, well, then we have to understand what it does on each basis element, but a basis element just creates a copy of R, and on R we already know what it is doing. So this is hand-waving. I fully admit that. We'll get back to this point later to make it really stick. But the third one is sort of the nice part of the argument. So now I want to show that this given natural transformation must be the multiplication with this element R on any module. So how do we do that? So if M is any R module, right, R module, then it admits a presentation of the form, we got some free module mapping onto M, and we might have a kernel, the relations between the generators. So what does it mean to give an epimorphism here or a subjection? That just means to pick a system of generators of M. Right? System of generators means that everything in M can be written as a linear combination of generators. So index the generators by some set I, take the free module and send the ith basis vector to the ith generator. That gives you a surjective map. Now you might have a kernel because these generators in general will not be independent. Well, I'll do the same with the kernel. There will be some generating set for the kernel. Might be huge, who cares? So it means that M can be written as a quotient of a free module modulo the image of another free module. But now look, we wish to figure out what is ZM. What is the action of this central element on the module M? Well, we already know what it is here, because Z on a free module is simply right multiplication by R. And similarly here, this is simply right multiplication by R. But then, these two maps together induce the right multiplication by R on M, and because the two have to coincide on the generators, so that means that ZM is right multiplication by R on M. So the upshot here is, and that's where the name comes from, that for the category of modules, the center of the category is the same thing as the center of the ring, of the original ring. No?
I'm wondering, wouldn't it have been a lot easier if there were tensor products around? You could say that every module is itself tensor the ring over the ring?
No, that I don't think would do it. What you need here is that what this statement here really says, in category speak, is R is a generator, the object R is a generator of the category mod R. In other words, every object is a quotient of sufficiently many copies of this generator. That's the key argument. I don't think it has anything to do with tensor products. but I'm happy to be convinced otherwise.
Because M is equal to M tensor R.
Yes.
Is also
but
saying that R generates.
No, then you need. You see, this is a typical. Sorry for doing this to you, but of one of the mistakes in trying to analyze the center of a triangulated category. Because it never says, you see, what you would probably like to argue is that Zm tensor, the identity, should be equal to 1 tensor Zr. But that's nowhere required. And that's an extra condition.
So then you have said something like that this condition is satisfied automatically.
In this case, yes. But a priori, there is no reason why it should be true.
Yeah.
And that's why, for example, again, jumping way ahead, but the sort of so-called category of theory of enriched categories, these are categories which have some kind of tensor product on them, is usually much simpler than the general stuff. But you always have to impose some naturality conditions. And then, yes, things simplify, as you immediately spotted. That's right. But it's not the general case. Okay, so now we did something about the two compositions. I gave you an example of a center. I want to say that the center of a category is, for example, also a very important object in the category, in the theory of quantum groups. Because one, this is so-called Deligny-Milne representation theorem for Tanakian categories. So you have categories which have lots of extra structure. And then there's a theorem which says that this category is completely known once you know the center. You see, this is not quite the case here. Knowing the center of the ring does not reconstruct the ring for you. There are many rings which have the same center. Like, for example, take the Weyl algebra, so polynomial differential operators has only the constants in its center, so you cannot distinguish it from a field. The field of scalars and the ring of differential operators have the same center, however, the categories of modules over the two things are completely different. But there are some circumstances, and these Tanakian categories or representations of quantum groups is one, where the center is enough to reproduce the whole category. That's more an aside. So the next, and I think I'll just have a break then because it's a natural point. So the next thing is Presheev's and Yoneda's lemma. Can be argued that Yoneda's lemma is the first non-trivial result in category theory. Again, once you know the proof, looks, yeah, okay, what else could it be? But just the formulation is something else. So, let's have a, I don't know, 15 minutes break, and then we'll do the second half. Yeah, so it's only 10 minutes, but everybody seems to be here, so why not continue? So I said that introduced precepts already last time, so the formal definition, so a precept on a category C is a contravariant functor from C into the category of sets. So, also written as functor from C up into the category of sets. And as I explained, I mean, you can define a pre-co-sheaf by saying these should be the covariant functors, but one does not necessarily use that terminology. But where does this terminology come from? It comes from this basic example where you take X, a topological space, and you take C to be sort of the category of open sets of X. And so the category of open sets of X, I think I'll define it already, is simply the classifying category of the set of open sets of X together with the inclusion. So that gives you a partially ordered set. Partially ordered set can be seen as a category where any two objects are connected by at most one morphism. And so that's a category we're looking at. And then what is a presheaf? So F, presheaf on X, is by definition nothing but the same thing as a presheaf in the categorical definition on the category of open sets on X. And so what does that mean? Well, it means we have a functor which to each open set, so U in X is open, we assign a set F of U. However, the inclusions, so if you have a second open set which sits inside V, then we can assign to it a set F of V, but the functor is contravariant, so we get a map the other way. And this is usually called rho UV of F, and it's sort of as a restriction map. So think of F of U, for example, giving you the set of all continuous functions with values somewhere in some fixed gadget on U. And then you have a smaller open set, and what you can certainly do with functions is restrict their domain. And so these would be the functions on U, and these are the functions on V, and there's a natural restriction map between the two. And then to say that it is a natural, that it is a functor, simply means that if you have U containing V containing W, and each, all of these are open subsets of X, then you assign to them F of U, F of V, and F of W. You have a restriction which goes first from U to V, and then a restriction from V to W. And to say it's a functor simply means that composing the two restrictions is the same thing as restricting all the way from U to W. So this, in other words, we have that rho UW equals rho VW, rho UV. So restricting in stages is the same thing as restricting all the way. Of course, something which in nature will always hold. And so one of the reasons why one takes as pre-sheaf's contravariant functors, it comes precisely from this heuristics, from this example. Now, we also talked already about representable functors. And just to recall that, so F, the functor from C up to sets, is representable if this functor is isomorphic to Hom C blank X for some X in C. So in other words, you fix the second argument and you let the first one run. That gives you a contravariant functor because Hom in its first argument is contravariant. The values are sets, so it is gives you a functor from C up to sets. And similarly, if you have a functor from G from C to sets, so a co-pre-sheaf, if you like, this is representable if G is isomorphic to Hom C Y blank for some Y in C. And of course, you need only one of the two notions because you can always switch to the opposite category to get the other one. Now, the most sort of simple examples of representable functors are in the second case, so in the covariant case. And let's see. And so here's some examples. And these are these forgetful functors. And I'll give you a whole list of them. So you see, for example, if you start with a group, we can forget that we have a group, and we simply consider the underlying set. So G dot, say, simply take the group G. So I'll make it as a table, and so we'll ask whether it is representable. And clearly, this is covariant, right? If you have a homomorphism of groups, it induces a map of sets, by definition, in the same direction, not in the opposite direction. So question is there, so what does representability in this case mean? So it means, does there exist a group, X, such that for any group, G, we have that the homomorphisms in the category of groups, in other words, the set of group homomorphisms from X to G, is the same thing as the set G. And of course, it should be compatible with ring homomorphisms. Is there such a group? The trivial group. So let's try that, just so that we all understand what we're doing. So if you have just a one-element group, what would be Hom in groups from the one-element group to G? So in this case, what are the homomorphisms? How many ways can you embed a trivial group into a group? One way, right? Because the identity element has to go to the identity element. So that's just one. A set consisting of one element. So that's certainly not G in general. So now you said let's take the group with two elements. Well, let me do it nevertheless. So what happens now? Because I think it's good to have some false positive first to understand what happens. So what is the set of group homomorphisms from the group with two elements into a given group G? This is a set, yes? It's a set of all G and G such that G squared equals the identity. So it picks out all elements of order 2. But this is generally not the whole group. So that didn't work either. Five elements, eh? No. Huh? Z. Okay, let's try Z. And of course, there's addition. Well, what happens now? What is the set of group homomorphisms from the integers with addition to any group G? Well, it's all of G. Namely, how do you get this bijection? You have a homomorphism phi. What do you assign to it? Phi of? Yeah, exactly. Phi of minus 1. Yes, it will work. Not your first choice, probably. Or phi goes to phi of 1. Because in either case, let's say we'll take minus 1. If I know what the value of the homomorphism is on minus 1, I know what its value is on plus 1 because it's the opposite. And I know it on all the multiples. Right? And 0 has to go to the identity anyway. So the reason is that Z is a free is the free group on one generator. And whether you choose to call the generator plus 1 or minus 1 from the point of view of group theory is the same thing. But it illustrates an important point, and that's why I didn't mind this comment at all, that this kind of identification here, if you say a functor is representable, it not only means that you have to find the object that does it, you have also to find the isomorphism. And there might be choices, like here. The object is a free group on one generator. The isomorphism is not unique. There are two choices here. So it works beautifully. Okay, so that's for groups. Now what happens if you take abelian groups and forget? Yes, which happens to be the integers as well. So now let me, because I messed up my table, so here we have the forgetful functors, and here we have the representing objects, if they exist, so groups, two sets. We had the integers and the map. The isomorphism was given by phi evaluated on 1 or minus 1. So if you take abelian groups to sets, same thing happens. And the reason is because the group that represents it in the general case, in the group case, already is abelian. What happens if we take the set of the category of R modules over some ring R, and we just look at the underlying set? Is it representable? And if so, what's a representing object?
Are we assuming the identities always or not?
Yes. So it didn't define any module categories over ring, over rings without identities. So maybe I should say it here just to make sure. So with multiplicative identity. It's a free module on one generator, so it is simply the R module R itself. Or if you like, 1 times R, and the map is phi goes to phi of 1. If you have an R linear map, if you have an element in an R module, if you have a homomorphism from R into a module, you evaluate it on 1, that gives you an element in the module, and this gives you the bijection between hom R R M isomorphic to M. Right? Okay, that was easy. Here's a slightly more difficult one. Take the rings and take the underlying sets. So the category of rings with identity and ring homomorphisms as morphisms. Forget that we have a ring, just look at the underlying set. Representable or not, and what is the representing object? No. Okay, well, now you don't want to mess this one up, so I'll do it here somewhere else. Maybe here. What is the category of ring homomorphisms from Z into a ring? Well, again, think about it. 0 has to go to 0, 1 has to go to 1, n goes to n times 1. So how many elements does this set have? Exactly 1, and this 1 is called the characteristic homomorphism, right? It's just a 1 element set, so it definitely does not reconstruct the ring as a set. So that try didn't quite work. So the integers, there's only 1 homomorphism from the integers into any ring, sometimes called the characteristic homomorphism, right? Because the image determines the characteristic of the ring. So, representable or not? So we need some wiggle room, right? We need to be able to pick out other elements just instead of just the identity. Huh? That's some? Well, how do you make it into a ring? Ah, that's a good one. So you want to say Z plus Z? What's the addition and multiplication? Coordinate-wise. Okay, fine. Coordinate-wise, addition and multiplication. So, exercise, what is the set of ring homomorphisms from Z plus Z, or Z cross Z, as one would normally write it, into R? How many homomorphisms? No. For example, there are already... what's the endomorphism ring of the ring Z cross Z? You certainly can switch it to copies. That gives you another homomorphism. Okay, so what is this set? It's an interesting question, right? So we know 1 goes to 1. But what about 1 comma 0? Do we know where 1 comma 0 has to go? No. But what happens? So let's say I'll try this. I have a homomorphism phi here, and I assign to it phi on 1, 0. Well, that's certainly an element in R, but what kind of element? It is certainly idempotent, yes? Because we have that phi of 1, 0 squared is equal to phi of 1, 0 squared, which is phi of 1, 0. So clearly, what we can pick out are idempotents. Can we pick out any idempotent? In other words, so we said, well, if we do this, then clearly we end up in this set of idempotents. Is it surjective? But that's not an issue, because if E is an idempotent, then 1 minus E is also an idempotent. Because, right, 1 minus E squared is 1 minus 2E plus E squared, which is 1 minus 2E plus E, which is 1 minus E. So that's not an issue. But let's try again. So we give ourselves an idempotent. Can we find the ring homomorphism from Z cross Z into the ring? Well, you see, I was wondering about whether somebody would say, well, how about this one? This is a relation, right? Here we have, this is E, this is 1 minus E. Yeah. And so, of course, the product is 0. But you see, this is also true in any ring, right? Because this is just E minus E squared. E squared is E, so it's E minus E is 0. So in other words, if you have an idempotent, then this relation is automatically satisfied. So indeed, it is true that the ring homomorphisms from Z cross Z with coordinate-wise addition and multiplication picks out precisely the idempotents. But it's not the ring. Sort of this is the same fallacy as before. This was a trivial group, right? It's a trivial ring, just one homomorphism. This is a group with two elements. Well, it didn't pick out all the ring elements, only the ones of order 2. And in this case, it is just the idempotents that get picked out. So what's a proper ring? No. It's way too complicated. That would be a really large set. And we didn't do any free products to begin with yet. So what should be the proper ring? So look what you have to do. The integers somehow have to be there, right? Because you have to have a 1 and the multiples of 1. But we also know that on the integers, this thing is extremely rigid. We can't do anything. There's only one homomorphism. We need some wiggle room. How do we create the wiggle room? Well, simply by joining a variable. Take the polynomial ring in one variable. Because what is a homomorphism from a ring homomorphism from the polynomial ring in one variable into any ring? Well, we already said that such a homomorphism on the integers, there's nothing we can do. This is done. But on the variable, we can assign it whatever we want. So this is isomorphic to R by simply sending a ring homomorphism to phi of x. And now drawer could say, why not? Minus x, yes, please. Right? So this is, in a sense, a free ring on one variable. Now, how about commutative rings? You see, here we are essentially, again, in the same situation as for groups, because the representing object here was already commutative. Well, of course, it still does the same job. Now, you can make your own examples. For example, if you have a Lie algebra and you give it its underlying set, what's going to happen? What would you like? Where would you look for a representing object? What should it be? Which is not exactly a good thing, right? So, exercise. Let's say you take Lie algebras, maybe over the complex numbers if you like, I don't care. Okay. Does it work?
From your mannerism, it doesn't, but I don't
know. Don't. Yeah, so does it work or not? So first of all, everybody understands what the free Lie algebra on one element looks like. Let's say we take complex Lie algebras, so not to make life too complicated. How would that look like? It's a one-dimensional vector space, and the basis element, of course, brackets to zero with itself. So can you send this generator to any given element in a Lie algebra? Is it a homomorphism? Yeah. So? So, just take the free Lie algebra on one generator. Okay. So here's again one mind-boggler. What about if you forget from sets to sets? Take a set and forget that it is a set. Just keep it. Representable or not? Exactly. So how does a free set on one element look like? So the identity functor on the category of sets is representable. All right. So here's a one which is, well, I'll give you two more, which are slightly more sophisticated. I define the category of endomorphisms of sets as objects, pairs X, F, where F is just a map from X to X. And the morphisms are simply the commutative squares. So we have X, this is one object, just a set with a map to itself. Here we have another one, which is a set with a map to itself. And so what should be the morphisms? Well, the morphisms are simply pairs alpha, beta, so alpha, beta, such that, I just want the same one. So just the typical, so that this commutes. And then there is clearly a forgetful functor, and I just forget f. So we'll take the pair x, f, and we assign to it x. So, representable or not? So he claims, Dra says, Z plus should do it. So first of all, we are looking at the set plus a morphism. So this plus has no role to play here. So what do you
No, I said Z sub plus, the positive.
Ah. So also known, so with zero or not?
Oh, I don't.
So also known as a natural number.
Yes.
Okay. And the endomorphism? Also a successive function, right? Yes, indeed. And this represents this functor. So, because what is, let's call this S, so what is HOM in the category of endomorphisms of sets from the natural numbers with a successive function to X, F? Well, clearly, you have a generator. Well, let's say my natural numbers include 0. So we'll send 0 to some element. So the map, so we claim this is the same thing as x. And so if we have a map here, a morphism, we simply assign to it phi of 0. And then clearly, conversely, if I give an object in x, I can beef it up to a morphism here by sending 0 to a given element x, and then 1 goes to f of x, 2 goes to f of x, etc. Okay. So that's fine. So this one is representable as well, even though at first glance you might think, well, how could it be? All right. So now comes a much trickier example. Let's take the category of finite groups to sets. So we did discuss representability of the forgetful functor from groups to sets, and we found a representing group, namely the integers. However, the integers are infinite. So what is the situation now? Representable or not? Any objecting opinions? But it's sort of a shame, isn't it? So it's true, it does not, it's not representable. So this one is not representable. However, it's almost, right? Because we go back to the false tries earlier on. Well, we said if you take a group with 2 elements and we map it somewhere, we get all the elements of order 2. If you take a group with cyclic group of order 3, we pick out all elements of order 3. Now, if you have a finite group, then each element has finite order. So in other words, if we were to take the finite cyclic group and map all of them, we definitely catch every element in our finite group. Right? So there are two ways out of the dilemma here. You can either say, well, we don't have the functor is not representable, but we have a representing family. Namely, if you take all cyclic groups, we don't need to worry about the trivial one, as we know. So this is just the multiplicatively written, but that's not the point here. It's a cyclic group of order n. then, well, we know that hom mu n to g is just the set of all g and g such that g to the n equals e. But if we take the union over all n, then clearly we get g. Yeah? Yeah, so now comes a good question. How would, do we organize these data? And this is a limit. It's a direct limit over these sets. But we'll come to this pretty soon. Well, so what you would like to do is you would like to think of an object which sort of has its only morphisms, one specific morphism to each finite cyclic group. So you want to organize, and I think that's what Drawer's saying, you want to organize these, the family of finite cyclic groups into one object. It will no longer necessarily be finite, but it will have all these things as typical images. Now you could argue it takes the integers themselves, right? Because each, the ring of integers or the group of integers under addition has a natural map restrict module n to each of these finite cyclic groups. But that sort of, yeah, by chance happens to be the right thing. But what this is, what really is going on is this is called, it's a pro-representable functor. Because you have these various cyclic groups that among themselves, let me say it like this. So for example, you have mu2, you have mu3, but you also have mu4, which of course maps to mu2, and you have mu6, which maps to both of them, mu2 and mu3, and so on. And so what you would like to do is you would like to ask yourself, is there some group out here which covers all of this? And so that from this group, there is a unique homomorphism into each finite group. Now the integers, as we said, would do it, but the integers are somehow not the right assembly for these finite groups. What would be the right assembly? I've never seen it. I don't expect you to know. But it's just what's called the inverse limit of these finite groups. So what's the inverse limit of the finite groups? That is what's called the completion of the integers. So it's much larger than the integers, but it is a topological group, all of its homomorphic images are finite. It's a risky completion with respect to the standard discrete. The pro-finite completion of the integers. So you take as open set every subgroup such that the quotient is finite. So, here we have what's called a pro-finite representability. In other words, there is no representing object, but we have enough objects that we can organize into a family so that it will do the job. Now, this is very vague and say, well, what is he exactly talking about? I don't blame you. But just to indicate that the situation we described here, where we had representing functors all the way, is not the typical one, but there are, might be ways around it. All right. Now here's the exercise for you at home. If you take the topological spaces and you forget the topology, representable or not? Let people think about it. All right. So this is sort of one typical case of functors two sets, which are sort of so obvious and so natural that you probably would never really spend any time thinking about them. Of course, the second example is, if you look at the given a category C, and you look at it with two arguments, the contra and the covariant one. Now, this gives you a functor from the opposite category cross the category itself, two sets. And so I realize I didn't define what's the product of two categories. So if you have C and D categories, then what should be C cross D? Well, C cross D is the category with objects X comma Y, X in C, Y in D, and morphisms, of course, pairs, F comma G to X prime Y prime, where F is a morphism in C from X to X prime, and G is a morphism in D from Y to Y prime. And so here, if you have a pair of objects, one in the opposite category, one in the category itself, and you assign to it the morphisms in the category, that's a set by definition, and it is a functor, which translates simply the normal category actions. So this is a functor. It's also called, not surprisingly, the Hom functor. Now, what's the importance of this is that it allows you immediately to, combined with what we just did, it allows you to define sort of enriched categories. For example, we'll say that C, let's say K is a commutative ring. And so then we can look at the K modules. We have a forgetful functor into sets. And then we have the Hom functor on any category C. And so a K-linear structure on the category is simply a functor which factors the Hom functor through the K modules. So here's a formal definition. So a K-linear structure on C is a lift of Hom C through the forgetful functor. Mod K. What does it mean? What's the concrete benefit of having a K-linear structure? Well, first of all, it means that instead of just having the Hom set considered as a set, it comes from somewhere up here. In other words, it carries a K-module structure. Yeah? And the compositions will be K-bilinear, because that's true in the category of K-modules. So, that simply means, on each CXY, we are given a K-module structure such that a composition is K bilinear. And that's obviously something which might be quite handy. If, for example, it means that you can add morphisms, because each home set now has an additive structure of a K module. However, key point to remember here is that I did not say, nor would I ever say, that such an F is unique. You might have on the same category different K-linear structures. But there's one very important case, so-called additive categories, where it is unique. And that, again, is a source of confusion, because some people would only consider K-linear structures for additive categories, but there's no reason to do so. So, that's where these two things come together. For example, I'll ask you, but this is tongue-in-cheek, sort of, on which, for example, on the category of groups, can you define the K-linear structure? Well, any K. Take K to be the integer, say. And said K is just some commutative ring. By the way, yes, thank you again. That was really very helpful all the time. So if K equals the integers, then one says instead of K-linear, one also says pre-additive. So a Z-linear structure is normally called so Z-linear is usually called a pre-additive structure, because all you essentially can do is you can add morphisms, and the composition is distributive over the addition.
So just not to be in suspense, what do we do to delete the pre?
I'll get there. But we just means. Well, the pre, to delete the pre means that the product and direct sum of any two objects have to exist and to be the same. The one axiom, remember the story I told you in the first class, David Buxbaum forgot in defining an abelian category. So, all right. So now we have talked a little bit about representability, and I gave you this example here for the how it relates to linear structures. And so now let's work a little bit harder on presheaves. So but first I'm not sure whether I gave you the definition in its full glory. So let me do it here. If you have C prime, the category of C is a full subcategory if, well, first of all, the objects of C prime are a subcollection of the objects of C, and that's important that the Homm sets are the same for those objects which are in both. So, if you don't wish to think of this as sort of a recall, we mimic this and say if we have a functor f from C to D, is full or faithful or fully faithful, if the induced map F from HUM in C from X to Y goes to HUM D FX FY. No, I wiggled myself out of room here. Sorry. I need some space at the back. So if F from HUM C X Y to HUM D FX FY, which takes the morphism F and assigns to it, which is part of the definition of a functor, the corresponding morphism between the images on the objects. So if this is a surjective, injective, bijective. And of course, for all X, Y objects in C. So it reflects the properties of the functor on the HUM sets. If it's surjective on the HUM sets, call it a full functor, because full in the sense that whatever happens in the images, you can find something which induces it. Faithful, well, that's pretty clear, right? You don't lose anything going from C to D. Morphisms that were distinct stay distinct. And fully faithful, if it doesn't matter whether you consider the morphisms over here or there, there is this in bijection. So, I also recalled that, or said that earlier, just as a crucial criterion aside, remember we said that F from C to D is an equivalence of categories. If and only if, or if there exists a functor going the other way, such that, well, if you take first F and then G, then we have a functor going from C to D back to C, so we can compare it with the identity on C, but we don't want it to be the identity, only to be isomorphic to the identity, and similar the other way around. And I said that isomorphisms of categories, which would require equalities here, are useless. They're way too restrictive. The right notion is equivalences. And so to tie it up with what I just said, so here's another notation. One says that F is dense if for each object Y and D, there exists an object X and C such that F of X is isomorphic to Y. So up to isomorphism, everything gets covered by F. So F hits each isomorphism class in the target category. And here's the proposition, which is very useful. You see what's bad about the definition of equivalence of categories is that often you have a functor, but you have no clue what the G is. And there might be no natural G around to begin with. So what you would like is a criterion which tells you right away F is an equivalence without ever having to worry to find G. And that's what the proposition does. So F is an equivalence of category if and only if it is dense and fully faithful. in other words, you hit every isomorphism class, and on the morphisms, you have bijections. Yes, to prove this, you need not only the action of choice, you need much more, depending on how you set up your set theory. Because remember, the objects of the category do not form a set. But your idea is exactly the right one. Namely, if we have a functor which is an equivalence of categories, it is both dense and fully faithful. This I leave as an exercise. So, the proof, this direction, there's nothing to it. Just checking, if you have G with and these isomorphisms, then the functor F has to be dense and fully faithful. This direction, exactly as Enrique says, well, this is where the set theoretic subtleties enter, if you so wish. Because what do you do if you have a dense and fully faithful functor? How do you define G? Right? That's, of course, the key issue here. You are given F. How do you find G? And why axiom of choice? What do you have to do? Well, basically, what's the thing you have to do here? Yeah. So you take G of Y, you define this to be X with Y isomorphic to F of X. But of course, there might be many such X, so you have to choose. But once you made a choice for every object in D, then the rest is automatic. There's no choice anymore involved on how to define the effect on the morphisms. Well, precisely, one should really say it's not just the X you choose, but you also have to choose the isomorphism, because Y might be isomorphic to F of X in many different ways. So this is a typical case, yes, if you feel that set theory should be taken seriously, then you might be very careful in using this. But for the sort of daily work with categories, this is a very useful criterion. Now, if you have small categories, then it's, of course, your axiom of choice that allows you to do this. So if you believe in the axiom of choice, then this is fine. Okay. So now what does this have to do with pre-sheaves? Just to remind you, I won't write it down again, that you call a category skeletally small or essentially small, both things are used for the same, if the category is equivalent to a small category. Now, better look up the notation because I always confuse the direction of the hats. Let's check it. Yeah. So given C, we set C hat to be the category of pre-sheaves. So hom from C up to sets, that's the category of pre-sheaves. Now, so these are functors, and again, we'll ignore questions of the universe. So if C is small, then there is no problem what this category is. If it's not small, well, then you have to go into the setup, say, of universes and enlarge your universe to be able to talk about this as a category. Let's ignore that for the moment. But then we also said, well, we have a natural map, functor from C to C hat. And this is called the Yoneda functor. Sometimes, namely, you take X and you set it to send it to h of x, I recall what that was, that's just the functor which is represented by x. Now, the crucial thing, and we looked through the examples, is, as you will see, something which comes up again and again and again, and lots of problems can be reduced to that question. If I have a pre-sheaf, is it representable or not? So what one would like to understand are the properties of this functor. For example, if this functor were dense, then it would just say that every functor on C is representable. Every contravariant functor is representable. Well, it doesn't happen too often. So, but then the question becomes, how can we tell? What is the relation between the pre-sheafs and the representable functors? And so here's Yoneda's lemma, and I'll give you various versions of it. So first version is H from C to C hat is fully face. Not dense. So that's, if you like, first version of it. Second version, slightly stronger than the first one, is for each x in C and f in C hat, the natural transformations in C hat from, well, I could write h of x, or maybe I should, to f is in bijection with f of x. So, this, if you want to write this out, you could write it out by saying this is HOM, the morphisms of pre-sheaves or morphisms of functors, where you have here the functor on C, and here you have the functor F. So we're looking at all natural transformations or morphisms between these two functors, and then the answer is, well, they form a set, which is not clear at all to begin with, right? Because here, because of the set theoretic difficulties that might arise, a priori, this could be a huge thing. Just look at, think of the data you have to provide to give such a morphism between functors. So the, one of the powerful consequences of Yoneda's lemma is that this is a set in the same universe where you started from. You did not enlarge sizes here. Now, and so I should also say what this map is. So let's give it a name. I think I call it phi. Namely, if you have, no, that's not what I call it, sorry. It's just the evaluation in X. Namely, so where the evaluation in X, if you take any morphism of functors from hx to f, you can take it and evaluate it on the identity of x. So what is this thing here? Well, this is, phi is a homomorphism of functors. So in particular, well, if you like, it's phi x. You have phi x going from hom c x comma x to f of x. Because remember, to give a morphism of functors means you have to give a morphism on each object. In particular, we are given one on x itself. And in here, we have the identity on x, and we can assign to it its image, phi x on the identity of x. And that's the element in here. All right? Now, let me give you, even though I know it becomes more and more atrocious, but let me give you the Eilenberg-Kelly version of this, which I have to look up, because otherwise I'll confuse myself no end. And it's the covariant version, so I leave it to you to define the contravariant one. Given CD categories, F morphism functor from C to D, D, K an object in C, M an object in D, and I apologize that the notation jumps all over the place, but that's because I took it straight from them, and I didn't want you to confuse with X's and Y's and so on, which could confuse me. So, given this situation, there exists, there is, a natural bijection where we have, and I'll write it out, here we have the morphisms of functors on C from HOM C K to HOM D M F blank. Into HOM D M F of K. Now, I'll describe this map, let's call it alpha and beta, and so what I'm claiming is that there are more bijections between the two sets. Now, let me first make a remark, namely, I wrote some set brackets here. But again, a priori, I didn't even know that this was a set. Only after the fact, establishing this, I know it is one. So how do you do it? Well, it's basically the same as in part two. Take a morphism of such functors. Well, then, what will be alpha of P? So that's supposed to be a morphism in here. So how can we fabricate one? Well, we take the identity on K and apply P to it. See, the identity on K is a map from K to K. Thus, P maps it to a morphism from M to F of K. And that's what these things down here are. So it's, and beta, we'll come to it in a second. Well, yeah, I can give you beta as well. So let's say we have some element theta in here. So question is, how do we come up with a morphism of functors? Well, so beta of theta should be a morphism of these functors. So in particular, so let me try to squeeze it in here. So we have HOM C from K blank. We can first apply F, because F is a functor, to get us to HOM D FK blank. F blank, sorry. Just take any morphism here and apply F to it. And then we were given theta, which is a morphism from M to F of K. So we can post-compose it and go to HOM D M F blank. So this is post-composition with theta. And so the claim is this composition is a morphism of functors, and it is a natural inverse to this map here. sufficiently confusing? So, now let's first clarify how these three pieces relate to each other. And to see that 3 is really the most general one. So 3 implies 2. Namely, you take V to be the category of sets, and you take M to be the set with one element. Namely, the representing object for the forgetful functor. So what happens then on this side? Well, you see, here, on this side, we would get the morphisms, hom in sets, from the point to F blank. Well, remember, this represents a forgetful functor, so this is just F of blank itself. And so, what this is saying is, we have that, so if you now read part 3 with these specifications, then it is saying that the morphisms from H lower K, right, because here we took the covariant functor, to F R in bijection with, what does the bottom line say? Well, it's a homomorphism in sets from one point to F of K, so that's just F of K. So it's a covariant version of 2. So perhaps I should write, this implies a covariant version of 2. But replacing C by C op, you get the usual one. So now, how does 2 imply 1? Well, what does it mean to say that our functor is fully faithful, so that the Yoneda functor is fully faithful? Well, that's to say that hom in C from X to Y should be the same thing, or in bijection, with hom in C hat, in the pre-sheaves, from H of X to H of Y. But by part 2, this is the same as H of Y applied to X. And by the definition of H upper Y, this is hom X Y. So this was a question we had. And so by part 2, we know that the morphism of functors is essentially the same as evaluation, and this evaluation just means this. Thus, we have a natural bijection between these hom sets, and thus the H from C to C hat is fully faithful. So, having said that, let me run through the proof, and I'm just going to prove part 2, because part 3 is really just a beefed up version of part 2. I just wanted to show it to you, to just give you the flavor of how one can generalize these things. So I would consider this sort of more show off than anything else. So let's give a proof of 2. Just to understand what it means, what is involved. So, we are already given the recipe. So we need to show that the evaluation of X is bijective. This map up here, which appears in 2. So what does that mean? Well, clearly, injectivity and surjectivity. So let's assume we want to do injectivity. So if we have phi and psi are two in the target. So these are two morphisms from H of X to F. Now what would it say to say that the two are not equal? You have two morphisms. So what is a morphism of a functor? Well, a morphism of a functor, so phi not equal to psi would mean there exists some object, y and c, such that phi y is not equal to psi y. And what are these? Well, these are morphisms from hx of y to f of y. And mind you, this is just Hom from y to x by definition of this functor. So it would mean that there were two, that there was a morphism. So in other words, there exists some morphism g from y to x such that phi y of g were not equal to psi y of g. Right? But now, we have not yet used that phi and psi are morphisms of functors. So let's see that. What does it mean that phi is a morphism of functors? Well, we can interpret what phi does to a morphism G in two different ways, and that's the whole key to the Yoneda lemma. Namely, first of all, we can so we have a map morphism from y to x, our g, and we have, let's say, phi we have phi y of g . And so what I claim that this is the same thing as f of g applied to phi x of the identity on x. Now why is that? Remember that phi is a morphism of functors from hx to f. So I think I wrote it the wrong way around, right? X is a target. So G is a morphism from Y to X. This is F of Y. Oh, let me check my notes. That's confusing enough without messing up all the notation. Yeah, so let me, so the correct identity is so we have phi I of g is f of g, as I said, phi x of the identity on x. So let's make sense out of this. And then you see, this means that if these two were different, then in particular, phi x of the identity on x and psi x on the identity of x had to be different. In other words, this here is the evaluation in X of phi. So why does this equation hold? So let's go back. Namely, for any morphisms G from Y to X and say F from Z to Y in C, one has look at the diagram. So here we have HX evaluated on Y, and here we have F of Y, and phi was a morphism of functors from H upper X to F, so we have some phi of Y here. Then we have HOM ZX here, let's say F of Z here. We have phi of Z. And now we can look at the I did the covariant version. No, that's okay. It's HX of Z. And so, how do we get from here to here? Well, by simply postcomposing with F, right? So we have any morphism from Y to X, and we postcompose it with F. That's a morphism here, and so it must, over here, it is F of F, because that's what the functor does, the Yoneda functor does on Y, and what it does on, on F. Right? It's a contravariant. So now, if you read this and you apply this to So now take Y equal to X here. Take this to be G. Sorry. F equals G. Then what do you get? Then here you get HOM XX, phi X goes to F of X, Y equals X and Z equals Y, right? Sorry. So here we have postcomposition with G, here we have phi of Y, and here we have F of G. And so if you now apply this diagram, which is just maps of sets, apply it to the identity on X, well, then you see exactly what I stated here. You have F of G combined with phi of X applied to the identity. This is going around this way. The other way is you take the identity composed with G, which is G, and then apply phi of Y. So the commutativity here, so this is the same thing as commutativity of stuff. And so, in particular, we see the injectivity of the Yoneda functor. Because everything, other way to say it is, everything is determined by this element in F of X. This also proves essentially the surjectivity at the same time, because you simply read the equation backwards, as is so often the case in this kind of situation. So, surjectivity, given some element z in f of x, define phi z on y and g as f of g of z. So, and that is, of course, so for any g from where did g go from y trans? So it's a transformation of functors. So we have to give a morphism for each object y, and to say what it does on the values of the functor. But the value of the functor hx on y are just all these morphisms g, and on the other side we have to end up in f of x. In f of y, and that's, we start with something in f of x, g is a map from y to x, f is contravariant, so this whole thing here is an element in f of y. And so one needs to check that phi z from hx to f is natural. In other words, it satisfies the corresponding associativity condition, but that's just built into the fact that f is a functor. So, end of story. Quite confusing, so take your time to work through it and think through it. What is exactly going on here? But by the way, this is sort of one of the incarnations where we said that to know a category, it's enough to know the morphisms. Because we said that the category C embeds into the category of presheaves. So in other words, there's no distinction between the objects and the functors that are represented by the objects. But the functor represented by an object, this is just all the morphisms to the object. So the Yoneda lemma can be interpreted also in that way by saying that that an object is uniquely determined by all the morphisms to it. Because this is what makes up the representable functor H upper X. Maybe it's worthwhile writing this down. Any object is uniquely determined by all morphisms to it, or the dual version from it.
What happens if you appreciate the
opposite? What would you like to happen? But what? Same is true for?
Since that if you're not old, I mean,
yes, I told you here, sort of the Einberg-Kelly version, where you have replaced the category of sets by something else. Right? By any category D. And you should think of this in connection with my remark earlier about K-linear structures. For example, D could be the category of modules over some ring, And then you can ask the same question if you are not looking at functors into sets, but functors, say, into abelian groups or K-modules. What is the precise situation there? And that's covered in here. And I showed you sort of how to reduce the corresponding Yoneda statement by just basically, so if this forgetful functor on D was representable, right, that's what we used for M, then this, here you find a set simply, and then as well as here, so you get the corresponding statement, Yoneda statement, but for a richer category than the category of sets. Yes? So these, think of these functors, that's what one all, sometimes does as well. One can think of this as a pre-sheaf on COP with values in D, or as a pre-sheaf with structure. So you can think, in a fancy way, you can think of a functor as a pre-sheaf with additional structure. I'm not sure it's too helpful, but... All right. So here comes sort of the mega application of Yoneda's lemma. And as so often with this kind of stuff, it looks so formal, you say, well, where is the content here? And so this is limits and colimits. I'm just, because we're running out of time, I'll just give you sort of the general definition, and then I'll spend next time on examples and relevant stuff. So the point here is this. So let's say we have I is a small category, and it's called I because you should think of it as an index set. Except that it's not a set, it's an index category. Now then you can consider, well, first of all, maybe it's time to introduce another notation. You say that an object, so given any category C, an object, or maybe I did it already, so sorry if I repeat myself. An object is final if an object X is final if HOM C Y X contains exactly one element for each Y and C. In other words, there's a unique morphism hitting X from anywhere. Of course, given Yoneda's lemma, we could say equivalently the functor F of Y is one point. So this pre-sheaf is representable. Sort of the constant pre-sheaf which assigns to every object just one element is representable. That's the same thing. Not very something very deep, just a reformulation to get you used to thinking both ways. Now, examples. Well, let's go through the list we had, which has now disappeared. Sets. Do you have a final object in the category of sets? And by the way, the dual notion, initial objects, so where there's a unique morphism from the thing to everything else. So, Does a category of sets have a final object? What is it? Single point. Does it have an initial object? The empty set, exactly. Right? There's a unique morph map from the empty set to any other set. Groups. Is there a final object? A group that there is exactly one homomorphism to that group? So a one element group, is there an initial object? Same one. If final and initial object coincide, they're called zero objects. Final equal initial, then we'll say zero object. Now let's see. Category of rings. Initial object, we discussed this already, has to be a ring which has a unique homomorphism to any other ring. It's the integers, right? And the unique homomorphism is what's called a characteristic. Is there a final object? The category of rings? The ring where there's a unique ring homomorphism to it. Yeah, so the ring where 0 equals 1. Which means it has exactly one object and one element, and this element represents both 0 and 1. So that's why it usually allows the idea to assume in a category of rings that 0 is not equal to 1, because you lose your terminal or final object. And so on. So I'll leave it to you. So what's the one thing I definitely want, if we look at all small categories, say, which we decided was also essentially just another algebraic structure. So is there a final category, or is there an initial category? So we look at the category of all small categories. So small categories, we said we could identify with some kind of monoids. The functors, we can identify, didn't do it, with homomorphisms between these monoids. But anyway, so is there a final small category? What should it be? Well, you have something to map to, so that there'd be at least one object and at one morphism. But that's what you want, right? So it is just this category here. Which has just one object and one morphism, the identity morphism. Which, of course, you can think of as a classifying category of the monoid with one element, if you like. Is there an initial category? Nothing prevents us. All we said in the small category, the objects have to form a set. The empty set is a set. And then there are no further conditions. Yes, so the empty category, which has no object, thus no morphisms, is the initial category, small category. All right. So, now you see, if you think of the analogy to set theory, then the final object in that sense, in that case, is the same thing as the representing object for the forgetful functor, right? And that's where the mistakes were made at the beginning, because you automatically thought that the final object should be the representing object. That's where the trivial group came from. that's where the integers came from in the category of rings. But, sort of what do you think? So we have, what we do now is, so we take, if we have our small category, and C arbitrary, then we define, and so let's F from EI to C any functor. And let's also single out the functors, which are the following, the sort of the constant functors whose value is the object X. So we'll go from I to sort of the trivial, the terminal category, final category, and then we send this object to X, comma the identity on X. So it's a, sort of the functor which takes I and collapses it all into the object X and the identity. And so here's a definition of the inverse limit over F. We'll look at the following pre-sheaf. So I'll explain. So we define the inverse limit along the functor F to be a pre-sheaf Well, which one should it be? Well, you take your object X and you map it into the morphism of functors from I to C from this functor EX to F. Second part, if lim F is representable, then we write small lim inverse F for the representing object. Sometimes this is also written as follows. So again, there are lots of different notations around. Sometimes this is also written as, lim over I of F. And similarly here, you would write this as the inverse limit over I of the functor F. But I think it is better this one because it leaves you sort of the true argument open. So, what the heck is this? Well, here's the exercise, and I'll stop because I'm running out of time. Take I to be the discrete category. So I is just discrete category. So just objects, no maps other than what's absolutely necessary, that is the identities. And by the way, so what is lim? So what is lim F for any F from I to C? How does it look like? What is what does it mean that it is representable? So in other words, lim F exists. What if C is replaced by the opposite category? What does it mean then? And by the way, so that's the last thing, just to finish this. So if F from I to C is any functor, then we define the direct limit or co-limit. So this is the direct or co-limit through, this is now a covariant functor, lim f of x is hom f dx in the category of presheaves on the opposite category. So it's a dual notion to the inverse limit, but what does it mean? For example, if you have a discrete category, what does it mean that the inverse limit exists, and what does it mean that the direct limit exists? What kind of objects do you get if they exist? Thank you very much.